They called her the little girl who lives down the lane. All alone in that big house. Who was she? And what was her secret? A lot of people wondered. Like Mario, the local comedian.
Somebody's out there.
Officer Miglioretti, the local cop.
I don't believe what you've been telling me about your father.
You're a very pretty girl, you know that? Pretty eyes.
Frank Hallett, the local creep. And nasty Mrs. Hallett, the local gossip.
Mrs. Hallett, I'm warning you!
I want to know what's been happening here in this house. I want to know what happened here today!
I think I should warn you that the police are watching our house right this very minute, Mr. Hallett.
Aren't you scared?
Of what?
Of being alone.
No one will know about us.
I never knew how much I needed you.
Now listen to me, young lady. I know you're up to something.
Go in that study, Mrs. Hallett, and I tell my father about your son. I even had to ask him why the police don't do anything about it.
Why should they do anything?
When your son gives candy to pretty little girls.
Academy Award nominee Jodie Foster, Martin Sheen, Alexis Smith.
Get out of here!
The little girl who lives down the lane.
This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
We're talking about the new Transformers film. No, we are not. We could, but that'll be a 30-second conversation.
From my end, it'll just consist of like fart noises, and then I'll put the camera on just so you can see me do like the little jerk off motion. Hey, new Transformers movie out!
It's the new Transformers movie trailer, folks. Hope you've got that visual picture, and we are live here on the spoiler room tonight. It is another big 4-0 special. We are winding out the year here, and I've been kind of excited to finally get to this one. And tonight we're going to be talking about The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, starring Jodie Foster and Sheen, who you've never seen him like this before. And tonight we've got a great cast here with us, a crew, to talk about this dark little picture. And first off, we have Mr. Cole Meredith is here tonight. Hello, Cole. How are you?
Fantastic. Good evening. Thanks for having me on, man.
Glad we could have you here. And next to him is the BFD himself. He is back, the one and only Glenn Bittner. How are you tonight, Glenn?
I'm super.
And next to him in his house, Scotty D is here. Hello, Scott.
Hey, good to see you.
Good to see you, too, through the wonders of the interwebs. Mm-hmm. And tonight, we are looking at The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane, a film that was written by Laird Cohen, who also wrote the novel. And it is telling the story of 13-year-old Rin Jacobs, who lives alone in a high-class Quebec small town. But unknown to the neighbors, she is leading a secret and dangerous life. Not sure quite about dangerous, but definitely secret. starring Miss Jodie Foster. And let's start off with Cole. Cole, how do you feel? What are your initial reactions when you first saw this film?
I really liked it. It's a weird blend of horror and mystery and adolescent rebellion and there's a little bit of awkward sexuality in there and a really perverse performance from Martin Sheen that's you know, high energy. You know, usually people play perverts low key, try to creep you out, you know, and rightfully so. But this performance is high energy and it's pretty brutal. And you get a sense of what's underneath this guy, but you never get to look at it. Much like the rest of the film, I mean, you just get a sense of what's going on underneath. Just enough to really make you uneasy, but it's not a horror film. I like this movie because, like a lot of the best movies about adolescence, I kind of walk right along the line of horror, but don't quite cross it. Donnie Darko comes to mind, although those two films have nothing in common. I think a lot of the best movies about adolescence really are the darker ones. And this certainly is one of those. I mean, the credits rolled like 20 minutes ago, and I'm reeling a little bit.
Was this your first time watching it?
It was, man. Okay. Yeah, I actually thought I had seen it a long time ago, but I had seen something else with a similar title. As soon as Jodie Foster showed up on the screen, I knew, wow, okay, I definitely never seen this. And that was great. I love knowing absolutely nothing about a film. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, then Martin Sheen shows up and holy cow, man.
Yeah.
What a wild film.
We'll definitely get to those characters. But that's awesome that this was the first time you saw it tonight. So, yeah, I would be interested in your take on some of the things in this film. Glenn, how about you? What were your initial reactions when you first watched this movie?
When I first watched it, I didn't remember.
Sometime
in college, but I remember thinking that, yeah, Martin Sheen's a creep.
you definitely look at him in a little bit of a different light after this role.
Yeah, he plays creep really well.
Well, he does. I'm not slamming his performance by any means, but it's just definitely one that it's not a role that you would picture him in all honesty, given his later pedigree. He definitely creepy.
Is it true, Mr. President, that you are a pedophile?
That would have been interesting to come up in West Wing. Oh, wow. Okay, now I just wrote a whole episode about that. There we go. Scott, I know you were looking forward to this episode.
I was really looking forward to this. This is like when the pick of the movies that we were doing for the anniversary, the Big 4-0 anniversary specials of all the films that were released in 1976. All these picks came up, and there was a lot in there where I'm like, oh, I'd like to take part in that. There was only like two or three where I was like, oh, I got to be on that. Please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. And this was one of them.
Yes.
And I was really happy that it made the cut. I first saw this. God, I want to say that I saw it when I was in college, but I think it was actually a little bit afterwards. I had discovered a video store nearby that had a very wide selection of all the Vestron and videos and everything that was released in the 80s and mid 70s right. and 80s mainly, actually. And I grabbed this one. I was really getting into horror way more hardcore than I had been. And also, I was huge, 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 huge fan of Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had, you know, pictures of her. I, like, saved interviews with her, everything. I mean, she's an amazing woman to me. She really is. I think she's absolutely, you know, of course, we're talking about one of her kid roles here. And once you grow into adulthood, yes, she was absolutely gorgeous. But also so amazingly talented. Her mind is just fascinating, very smart, very funny. Can really catch you off guard with the choices she makes and the comments she makes. Just really great about it. So, and I got the VHS of this, and it was the one that features her like this blonde girl in a graveyard and everything. Yeah. And they made it look like it was kind of like, okay, she's going to be playing something like the Bad Seed in this. Mm-hmm. It'll be like the Bad Seed or the Omen or something like that. And the movie isn't like that at all, and I'm so thankful that it isn't, because it is so much more interesting than that. And I'm not sure the movie could get made now. I'm sure that conversation will come up, but I mean, it's just like one of those really fascinating roles to put a young person in, and she carries it. It's a really incredible movie.
Oh yeah, I think they picked well with casting Jodie Foster as the main the title girl, basically Rin, who the little girl who lives down the lane. Jodie was really impressive in this role, and from what I read up on it, I guess it was she really didn't like shooting this film, which kind of creeped out in interviews years later. But in this role, she sells it, and I really dug her character Rin and how she portrayed her, because even the way she walks, we get the opening scene, and this was what hit me. When I first saw this, I really loved it because it wasn't anything what I expected, especially from, you know, a young actress like that. But what got me was that opening where she's walking, and I was paying more attention this time for the show, and I realized that she didn't even walk like this may sound weird, but like a teenager, like a kid, if you will. Even the walk that she had seemed mature. I mean, she plays this character off very well. You know, after when you see her walking down the bench after the initial creepy scene with Martin Sheen, but even in her delivery of her dialogue, everything, she pulls off mature. You forget at times, I think, that she is supposed to be 13. Well, 14. She actually had her birthday during the shoot. Jodie Foster is just amazing in this. But I like the Rin character because she seemed like almost more mature than many of the adults around her. Glenn, what was your take with the Rin character?
I like her. I think she does an incredible job in this film.
Would you say her character, too, the way they wrote her, she was kind of more mature in some ways than the adults?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, she can definitely take care of herself.
Yeah, I mean, because when creepy Martin Sheen shows up, she just immediately goes on the defensive. She knows this guy is not, you know, not on the level. And she just immediately comes into defensive mode and puts him on his heels, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. Cole, what'd you think of the Rin character?
I thought she was fantastic. You know, again, as you guys have mentioned, very mature, and you can tell that she's smarter than, you know, almost all of the adults in the film, if not all of them, actually, now that I think about it. But also, you know, like a teenager, like a 13-year-old, makes completely horrible decisions. And as we find out near the end of the film, she's not capable of taking care of herself. At least that's what I read into it. Without her lover, you know, without this true love that's kind of come in and balanced her off and is helping her, you know, sort of find her way through this, because she has kind of strayed from her path. I do think she's lonely, and it takes her meeting this boy who has a slight disability that he's overcome of his own to sort of realize that she's not complete and that she is scared. And like I was saying earlier, I mean, you know, obviously teenagers shouldn't necessarily be, you know, burying bodies and then having sex later on. But I think all of that is just a metaphor, you know. I think it's all a metaphor for just this really touching story of a girl who's out there on her own, you know. I love, and Jodie Foster, of course, is perfect. Scott said it best. I mean, she's a phenomenal actress.
What's amazing in this film is that she is that how would you, I mean, if you have a role like that, that's not like any other role for a child actress, really. How do you approach that? How do you do it? Well, what Jodie Foster does in this movie, she plays Rin as an adult. We get the feeling very early on that she is far more cultured, far more even world-wise than many people around her, and that she's warned the world will not understand you. They will try to make you into this, who they want you to be. And she presents herself, and yes, as you were saying, Mark, even walks as an adult, and you keep on waiting for that moment. Now, I would slightly disagree. I think that she is able to take care of herself, but she has seen a lot of the, you know, trappings and how, I mean, it requires so much energy, and she is, as Cole correctly pointed out, very lonely, and that's the price of it, and she doesn't want to live that way. She wants to have somebody. But she does everything as an adult. You keep waiting for this moment when things will get too much and she will become this scared, helpless little child cowering in the corner. And thankfully, that moment never comes. Mm-hmm. She remains in control of at all times, even when, again, as Cole mentioned, that she's making bad decisions. They're her decisions.
Right.
There's not that sense of, oh my God, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Mommy, Daddy, please help me. That does not happen in this film. I mean, the closest you get is that moment of panic when the first body drops. And yeah. She's in the corner. She's like, oh, God, now what? You know, basically it just – and you know, you come back to her realizing that, oh, no, she's not, like, freaking out and scared and everything like that. She's trying to formulate, okay, now how do I handle this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is more mature than the world around her. She's more mature than anybody. And this is not an easy thing for anyone to do, especially her age. You know, she's a phenomenal actress. I mean, you got to think that 1976, she was in 5 movies this year. This isn't even her best movie of the year. But I mean, she's had a lot of maturity to it. And I think that I like to think that part of that was Jodie Foster. Because, I mean, if you do make 5 movies in a year, chances are you're not getting the same schooling, the same socializing that your peers are. You're traveling the world, and especially to make the decision to go approach the part like this, it's obviously that she was already thinking of, not thinking of, like, they're going to say action, and I'm going to flash my baby blue eyes and collect a paycheck. She was actually thinking, like, okay, now how can I do this, and really examining her craft. Mm-hmm. And good God, how many 13-year-olds think about their craft? And she was not only thinking about it, she's an expert at it.
Yeah, well, she had the experience. I mean, before 76, I mean, she had been, you know, in front of the camera quite a bit, and that shows...
Since she was a baby. She was the camera phone kid. Yeah,
I mean, but, and that shows here, and I think there were very few, especially young actresses back then, that could have probably carried this role like she does. You know, Cole mentioned something earlier about you know, how her character, you know, needed, kind of had that, you know, she kind of latched onto the guy and she fell in love with him, quote unquote. And, you know, she let her guard down a little bit. And for me, I looked at that almost as, you know, infatuation was a weakness that kind of almost made her slip up a little bit, it felt like to me. You know, her letting her guard down, but at the same time, she seemed to lose a little bit of that edge while she was with the young boy. But maybe my perception was off. Glenn, did you feel that way a bit, that maybe she may have weakened a little bit because of the infatuation that grew for the magician?
I don't know if I'd say weakened. I mean... Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so. I mean, it's I think maybe relaxed a bit.
Okay, well, maybe that's the vibe I got then. Yeah, that she was relaxed rather than tense, because when we first meet her, she is wound tight.
well, yeah. I mean,
sorry, go ahead. That nosy ass woman.
Well, yeah.
Oh, my jars.
Well, that's what got me, was the people. I mean, first off, you got Creeperson, the creepy man, Martin Sheen, showing up. Frank Hallett, who, man, he opened the door, and the entire audience knows exactly what type of guy he is. I don't know if it was the wild eye look he had or what, and you know, she played that so well with her hard edge, you know, but she seemed to have lost it. I thought maybe, but maybe it was just her relaxing, and we don't get to see her relaxed in the beginning, and maybe that's the change that I saw.
Well, I think that that she is, she does become more relaxed and everything like that, and around him, and that I'm sure that meeting Mario there, the her love interest, was not in the father's plans, and
right.
would definitely be straying from the path, but. And you could think of it as a weakness. I think it was just no, she was just kind of figuring things out. I don't think she necessarily got sloppy, because she was actually getting sloppy before he showed up. If you notice, it takes Mario to say, wait a minute, when she says, why didn't you put the keys in through the mail slot? Why would she put her keys through her own mail slot? You know,
right.
I mean, he was the one pointing that out, and they weren't even involved yet, you know, so... I think it was just definitely unplanned, and might not have been like smiled upon by her father.
Sure.
For her to have a relationship before she becomes like 16, and can go out on her own, I suppose. But it just gave it allowed her to look at things a little differently and gave her a new purpose. I don't think that it necessarily weakened her or caused her to be careless as much as it shifted her focus.
Well, were they possibly leaning a little bit too that she did still, because of her age, need that guidance? I mean, she had her plan from her father, but as you said, Mario kind of gave her the guidance she hadn't thought about, because
she was doing okay. She just, but like Cole said, she, you know, you're a kid. You're not going to make the greatest decision. My God, adults don't make the greatest decisions in the world. I mean, especially in America. it's amazing that she has the foresight to, you know, make the traveler's checks last, to
the
look
smoking.
Into this. To do the smoking, to
yeah.
Research the bylaws, to do that, to actually, like, you know, the subterfuge and the deception of her existence takes up so much energy, and it's amazing that she has the foresight to keep up on it. That, yeah, she's gonna slip up every now and then. This gives her somebody else to lean on when to say, hey, wait, you know, when she does make a careless mistake, you know.
The way this film starts and opens, you get really, it plays a little bit, I think, off the audience expectation, because you know the title of the movie. So we start off right away why she's alone. We don't get for a while actually why she is actually alone, what's in the cellar, creepy stuff. I mean, they really take their time to reveal that. Cole, what'd you think about how this film started? I mean, it basically started out with a lot of mystery around her character, but yes, also I think played off audience expectation of, yeah, you know, she's going to be alone. We're just not going to tell you why right away.
Absolutely, man. The opening of this film is phenomenal. It's one of those movies where two or three scenes in, I just knew I was in love with it. You know, I'm finding myself leaning forward and turning up the volume every 5 minutes and getting really annoyed with my family when they're talking, and, you know, like, all the signs of a really good movie, man. But specifically, I mean, just the scenes with the adults. I mean, these adults are just attacking her. And maybe this is specific to my experience as an adolescent. But I remember being a teenager like it was yesterday. I hope to be like John Hughes, where I can carry those memories till late in life. Because I can remember just how big of pricks almost every single adult was. And I try to be the opposite, you know, with every young person in my life, starting with my young actors, but with the little man in my life as well. But this is, you know, obviously these are exaggerated characters in a horror mystery thriller. But it rang true. It rang true, and it sucked me in, especially with What's the older woman's name? The character? Where are my notes?
Mrs. Hallett.
Yeah, I mean, she was basically just offended because Jodie Foster's character was a strong young person and wasn't falling into line. And just because of that, she seemed like she was just going to dig and probe and just cause a fuss and a stink. I thought the opening of this film, the first 20 minutes or, you know, the first couple scenes are just phenomenal. That Martin Sheen scene, man, should be studied. I'm going to study it. I love it, man. Really good stuff.
Because that's a hell of a way to start this movie. I mean, you know she's alone, and within 3 minutes, we got a pedo on the doorstep. Yes. You know? Yeah. I mean, it does not waste any time to show, you know, what danger, but it also does an excellent job of showing how her character thinks on her feet most of the time. Glenn, what'd you think about how it opened, where we really don't get a lot of explanation about anything, but we see how she goes basically toe-to-toe with two different adults in this movie?
I think it was a great way to open it. I mean, you're given an insight to her, like, immediately of that, you know, that she's not your typical 13-year-old, you know, idiot kid.
Yeah, I mean, especially first with Martin Sheen, where he shows up, she immediately assesses the situation, knows he's a creeper, and immediately starts trying to take ways to either get him out of the house or, you know, stay protected or whatnot, you know. And then when the Mrs. Hallett shows up, oh, I love that scene, because those two just go toe-to-toe, and you see Mrs. Hallett try to push, and Jodie's not moving. You know, Jodie Foster's character, Wren's, not moving at all, and I love that whole scene, how it was acted, because especially with those two, you know, she was trying to be alpha female in the house, and Wren was having none of it.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, the way she handled that, especially her art of words, Scott, how'd you like how Rin's dialogue was written, and how she was able to use basically distractions and her age kind of as a distraction at times when she didn't want to answer a question?
Oh, she knew completely that it was a tool she could use. Mm-hmm. To throw people off the scent. They're expecting to see a child. They're not expecting to see this well-mannered, well-cultured adult in a child's body. They're not expecting somebody who can, if you try to insert your authority on them, they're not expecting somebody who can stand up to you and say no, not as a brat, but as somebody who is actually superior to you. You look at how she dances around the dialogue and everything. It's fantastic. Also, the way the scene is shot. I mean, if you look the way director Nicholas Gessner shoots this scene, there's like shots where the camera will suddenly like move back and forth between the two, but not just move back and forth. It'll actually shift in and out of focus so that Mrs. Hallett's in focus, and it shifts over to her. Then it shifts over to Jody. She's in focus. To Wren, she's in focus. Then back to Hallett, then Wren. Then Hallett, then Wren. And it's playing this cat and mouse game that is just keeping in tone with the film. They're not expecting somebody that could actually call them on their shit. I do think that Ms. Hallett character also is some of the unspoken things you can pick up about why she wanted to meet the father so much. She was trying to move in on the father.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, here's a guy... Yeah. Who's cultured and has and seems to have money. I'm going to get in there on him, and well, maybe we could work some sort of arrangement out and something
well,
like that.
Well, you can see where some of the Martin Sheen character came from in her, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, because she's his mother, so yeah.
Absolutely. Whereas, though, even if the guy was alive, he'd had nothing to do with her because she's a xenophobe. I mean, she constantly starts talking about Wren and her father as, well, your people, I know, don't do this. And then when she's like looking at the Hebrew album, she says, well, why not learn French or Italian? Lord knows there's enough of them to talk to. I mean, she is like everybody's nightmare of a small town white woman. I mean, she's just this really horrible racist, authoritarian, ignorant person who with a predatory instinct, mm-hmm. and probably was never and had basically lived most of her life without having too many setbacks. She even got to have her son's pedophilia swept kind of under the rug, at least from a legal standpoint.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and was not expecting to meet her match with this kid.
Well, that was what's interesting is that, especially the mom and son Hallett, those two, I mean, who knew Canada had redneck small towns?
I imagine it has quite a few of them, just all that space, you know. I haven't been. I want to go. I love you, Canada. I really want your health care. I imagine it has quite a few.
I think it set it up, though, by putting it in a very small town. You know, the dad, we get explanation later through exposition as Rin confesses to Mario the magician pretty much everything. Because she's been holding it in just way too long, I think. But we get that explanation. But I think by having them European, it helped explain the attitude of the small town towards her and what would have been, you know, her father. You know, because they are worldly and he is an author. And here he comes to real small town Quebec, Canada/America. And that, you know, having seen small towns and living in kind of a small city town, that was actually kind of accurate as far as how people might put them up a little bit on a pedestal because of the mystery. How about you, Glenn? You think the setting helped kind of set up her character by putting them in such a small backwoods town?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's just if having had, I mean, personal experience living in small towns and, the type of behavior, the fact that, oh yeah, you know, that's their kid, he's a pedophile, it's just kind of like it's known, but you know, it just everything just seems to fit well with the story and the characters, because these are the type of people. Oh yeah, small towns, and you know, they're local bitches and pedophiles, that's just how it is.
they just deal with it, and the kids at school know who to avoid and who not.
Yeah.
Not, and it also added, I think, to her, I think, believability, Rin's character, by having her been kind of worldly, it buys into a little more of how she's able to, I think, go toe-to-toe with these adults versus, say, taking the small-town high school kid and try to do the same thing with. I don't think they'd be able to because they haven't experienced or been taught like Rin has. So I just thought having her from Europe and having seen the world kind of added to her character and the believability of how she could go toe-to-toe with just about anybody in the movie. So then we've talked about him a few times. Let's just dive a little bit deeper into Martin Sheen's character. He's the pedophile, and everybody knows he is, but he's also kind of got that feel of, you know, the rich parent. You know, I could do pretty much what I want in this town to a certain extent. What'd you feel about Sheen's character? I mean, not just being the pedophile guy, but is his character in general and his presence in the town outside of the law. Did you get that feel kind of like he was the rich popular boy who could do just about anything?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's pretty much what he is. I mean, his mom obviously has some importance in the town. And yeah, he's as the child of, you know, it's a perfect small town thing too. You know, it's, there's always those prominent families. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they can pretty much do anything. I mean, we learned that in Roadhouse.
Well, they hint at the fact that she is from retail and realty. So she sells land, and she probably is one of the only realtors in town. Cole, you live in a fairly small town.
Not for long.
Not for long.
Two weeks, man.
Wouldn't you say the sole realtor or someone who was in realty and sells a lot of properties might hold a little bit of power in a small town.
Oh yeah, this is completely accurate. Mm-hmm. And you know, in many, many small towns, not just the one that I you know have been in, but yeah, it's accurate, man. That's all I can say.
Could you see kind of Martin Sheen's character possibly getting away with what he?
Oh yeah, with? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Every. Of course. Very realistically, I don't want to get too deep into that, but it's mm-hmm. true. It is true. I mean, you know, hopefully with the NSA out there, we can get rid of some of these guys, you know. But but yeah, it's true. And they do. If you got a family with clout, I mean, obviously not just perverts, but you know, anybody. No, just, you but- know.
Yeah, you could get away with it for
you anything. Get away with things. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like Glenn said, you know, there is this weird thing where in a small town, everything has to fit because that's what mm-hmm. makes it a small town. So you keep the routine going because there's this fear of things growing beyond anybody's control. They want to be part of what they can understand, you know, which is a lot of times it has to do with the church. A lot of times it has to do with, you know, the local law enforcement. You know, the power source can come from anywhere, but people can get away with things maybe they wouldn't ordinarily get away with in anywhere else. I certainly have stories that'll make it on the screen one day. Many of them have, but it's not unrealistic, you know, for a schmoozer like that to show up at a young girl's door and for the town to look the other way, you know.
Yeah, and this is just before he takes on Apocalypse Now. I mean, this is just a few years.
Yeah, but he was already, you know, he was already shaping up. I mean, he had done, if you look at his filmography, he had done like a lot of TV work. Mm-hmm. But he was already kind of known because 3 years before this, 3 or 4 years before this, he had already been in Badlands.
Right.
Which is, you know, if anybody here has not seen that, or anybody listening has not seen that, you really need to see Badlands. It's
one of the greatest films ever made. Oh, one of the greatest films I've ever seen.
It's fantastic. He basically plays kind of a spin on the Starkweather character, and he was absolutely psychotic and unhinged. Here he is a different kind of psychotic and unhinged, and it's what I had forgotten in the 15 years or so since I had last seen this film was that for some reason I had remembered him still playing this part as a young person, maybe like around 18, 19. I'm realizing immediately when you watch the movie, like, oh no, he's an adult. He's a fully formed adult. And I thought one of the creepy things I thought was that he shows up at the door and immediately barges in, and he has marked this girl.
Yeah.
He knows that she's usually around the house alone. He knows that you know, she's got this long hair that he likes and everything. He's so, oh God, he's so creepy. Anyway, he's marked her in advance, and it's Halloween night, and he just barges in there and starts flirting and doing all these things, and he says that he has two kids waiting outside. Well, your first instinct is, no, he doesn't have two kids waiting outside. Right. He's just getting into her house. And then you see when he leaves, no, he had his two kids waiting outside. I'd totally forgotten about that. That was really unsettling, that this is a married guy with two kids. What kind of example is he setting for them?
Yeah.
What kind of person for money marries off a known sex offender to this local girl, local single mom, because it was related that these weren't his children.
Right.
And other dialogue. Oh my gosh, yes. And, you know, Martin Sheen's one of the great actors. He's played presidents. He's played small town nobodies. He's played psychotics. He's played near messiahs, you know? I mean, he's like this new spin on creepiness that, as Cole pointed out, is very realistic. I mean, if you've grown up in a small town, you know that one person. Well, yeah, there was this whole big mix-up with this, you know, be it a sex crime or a rape or some kind of drug thing or a crime like a robbery or something. But their last name is such and such.
Yeah.
So they got away with it, you know, and that happens all the time, you know, in these small towns. And as Cole rightly pointed out, this it was extremely – the way it handled all these people was very realistic. Someone who I know Cole and I like, and I think everybody here we all like, are the films of Wes Craven.
Yeah.
And a recurring theme, and a recurring theme like in Nightmare on Elm Street, in the Nightmare on Elm Street movie, the first one especially – and also in the compromised film he did afterwards, Deadly Friend, was how was the cruelty of adults and everything like
right.
that. Occasionally, in those movies, the cruelty and the just pig-headedness of these adults are exaggerated to get the point across. Mm-hmm. Here, they really don't seem exaggerated at all. It seems completely plausible as predatory and as mean-spirited as they are. You're like, no, this I can see her having to face this. Yeah. Absolutely.
Of course, not everybody in town is horrible. We do have the cop.
No. Yes,
he's
a nice guy.
we have the Italian cop who's the uncle of her boyfriend, I believe he is. And I liked his character quite a bit. In fact, I think this was his, because he was a musician. Isn't he the musician as well?
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to like look up here, because what was his thing? Oh, yeah. He wrote, he was one of a songwriting duo. Holy cow, did he ever write some good songs. Why must I be a teenager in love? Also, this magic moment, you know, all those. Yeah, he did like a lot of stuff. In the 50s and 60s, apparently.
Yeah, more.
Yeah, that's as good as the singing gets on my end, guys.
I liked Mort Schumann's character quite a bit because he's just a guy, you could tell he's the small town law enforcement who's just trying to do his job, you know. Nothing really big ever happens, I think, in town outside of, you know, pedo sheen. I just liked his character. I liked that she was able to find an adult. It felt like that she somewhat trusted. She trusted the police officer, would you say, out of all the adults?
She trusts him. Yeah. She's still going to lie to him because she has to. But I think that she got – and she's not going to let him in on her secret because she knows that not only is he from this – world that wouldn't understand. He also represents an actual official authority figure who would be, you know, honor bound to, you know, turn her in. But she does, I think, respect him a great deal. She doesn't bear this person any ill will whatsoever and would probably be really upset if anything unfortunate were to happen because of the way she lives. Well, I think he is a trustworthy figure, even if she is not.
I think it's because the way he approached her in the beginning, you know, it was immediately like, are you okay? You know, is he bugging you? You know, he didn't come off, you know, trying to be aggressive at all or, you know, downplay her because she was a kid. He just talked to her like a person. So I think that helped her warm up to him because the other adults up until that point pretty much were, you know, aggressive and conflicting. And
don't forget also that the way they talked about his previous crime where the Martin Sheen character, Frank, had dragged, as they put it, dragged some kid off into the bushes.
Yeah.
They specifically named him as the cop who tried to prosecute him, and he couldn't protect that other little girl,
right?
But he sees this guy, you know, putting the moves on Rin. You should stay away from that guy. I wouldn't let him in their house if he's that. And he's gonna keep an eye on him, and he's gonna make sure that he can't do the same thing. He's being protective in a way because he couldn't fulfill his duties before.
Right. But yet he's not too restricting because when he finds out his nephew is over at the house, he kind of plays along but lets them still have their romantic dinner, which led to a really great humorous scene. I kind of enjoyed the way the Mario, Scott Jacoby plays it. But the Mario, the magician, he's sitting there on the couch and she's kind of warmed up to him and she starts confessing. And she's talking about the tea that she poisoned her mother with, because this was the big reveal and the big turning point in this film where she reveals pretty much everything. And we realized, oh yeah, it's not just the landlady that accidentally died by dropping the cellar door on her head. No, her mom's laying down there dead as well, because she killed her by poisoning the tea, and she's telling Mario this as he's drinking tea. Glenn, how'd you like that scene at all? I thought that added a nice little bit of humor to what was up until that point kind of a dark film.
Oh, it was still a dark film. It definitely adds some humor. And I think in darker film like this, you need at least a little bit of that to lighten it a bit, to make it where you're uncomfortable watching it, but you don't want people to be so uncomfortable that they don't finish watching it.
Right.
So you need something every now and then to break things a little bit. And I think this was a great way of doing that.
Yeah, it was, because it wasn't too sad. And I think it put in the audience, too, just a simple doubt moment that, oh, shit, did she actually poison him? Because you wouldn't put it past her at this point, would you, Cole?
I had that moment. Yeah, I had that moment where I thought, yeah, I did, yeah. Well, I didn't know what was going on at that point quite yet, sure. You know, and then... and then shortly thereafter, it becomes, you know, a little bit of a love story kind of for a while. So they ease off that inclination pretty quick. But yeah, I definitely had that thought. But really what that is just to build in the key plot point that she doesn't take milk in her tea, you know, which comes into play later. So it works on a couple different levels. You know, I think it sets up the very ending with her and Martin Sheen. And also if you have a weird little comical moment, well, what the hell? That's good.
Yeah, there's a few couple moments, and I think Glenn's right. Even with any dark film, you know, especially with kind of uncomfortable subject matter that this film addresses head on.
Yeah, yeah.
You need a little humor to lighten it. Otherwise, yeah, people are just like, I can't watch the rest of this.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Just way too much for me. But yeah, the tea, oh, I loved how the tea set up the finale of this film with how she takes out Sheen, basically. Scott, which glass does she put the poison? It's the same poison that she kills her mom with, and she puts the powder not in the glass he was going to be offered, but which glass she puts it in.
Exactly. She puts it in the one that's closest to her, and you can see the difference because they're completely different glasses. I was paying very close attention to that. As Cole just mentioned, she doesn't take the milk in her tea, so that should have been a giveaway. But there's that moment because she thinks she's cornered, and she thinks she's going to have to – and there's this – Martin Sheen wants – to enter this really disgusting agreement with her that, you know, oh, you can live like this way, but I'm going to be your special friend. And I'm, oh my God. Ugh.
Yeah, I know.
But it's just, I mean, you can't even say it without getting like creeped out.
Long then, winter nights.
Yeah. Just, oh,
that conversation just makes your skin crawl the way exactly. He says it.
But so I'm watching this and she says, you know, Lord. I guess you can take care of yourself. And she says, I thought I could. And as she's putting the stuff in, and you really don't know for the longest time. Okay. Cause you see the one that she puts it in and that she does not put it in his.
Right.
You like, and you don't know for the longest time. Did she know that he was going to take that cup? Or did she intend to say, I'll end it right now if I have to?
And that's the question I had with it, too, was at first I thought it was, I clearly cannot choose the poison in front of me.
Yeah.
I can't clearly choose the poison in front of you. That popped into my head, too, for a moment when that happened. But it made me think that is she actually going to off herself so she can get out of this situation? Mm-hmm. And then, oh no, this is a moment where she figures he's going to take it. So that is still a question that you don't quite have answered, because either one, I think, seems plausible.
And I think she would have been prepared to do either. I just don't know which, if she knew he was going to take it. But as Cole mentioned, the milk is kind of a giveaway.
Well, she does put some milk in her tea. She does put some milk in both, but the reason he takes hers is because she put more milk in his tea. He makes a mention of that, because she actually puts milk in her tea as well for that, because she says, you take it like I take it. So everything he asked for, she put in both cups.
She puts the milk in his tea after he corners her, if I remember it right. The "you take it like I take it" refers to a sugar cube. Boy, I'm a movie geek. I think they're just talking about the sugar cube. I think after he, pardon?
She did the milk and then the sugar.
Oh, that may be. I seem to remember like him saying, you know, yours has milk in it. And then she reaches over and puts one in the glass, and he still says, no, I want yours. But maybe I'm misremembering it, you know. I've only seen it once.
The way I read it was, yeah, she first had put the milk in, but his comment while I was listening, and I may have heard it wrong, but was that you had put more milk in mine than yours. And that's why he took hers, because he thought she was giving him a dose of medicine. Let's ask Glenn. Glenn,
I think it was because he wanted actually to take something from her.
Oh, that could be,
because he's that much of a creep.
Yeah. So Glenn, do you think she was doing it because she may have wanted to take it herself as a last resort, or do you think she knew?
She knew it. She knew exactly what she was doing. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, no, the second I saw her poison it and have her teacup, I'm like, oh yeah, he's gonna switch it. She knows that he's gonna try to switch it. Yeah, no, she knew exactly what she was doing.
Because also the way she took the cups, the other cup that she gave him was the lesser of the two cups. It wasn't as ornate. Maybe there's just a little bit in that as well, that he wanted the bigger cup. Or like Scott said, and Cole alluded to, that it's because it was hers and he wanted to take something away from her. In any case, so you think, Glenn, too, though, that she all along knew he was just going to take hers because he thought he was outsmarting her as well, I think, in case she did poison him.
Yeah.
And then at the end, that end credit sequence, it doesn't end like a regular film either, really, because we don't get to see Sheen die, but we hear him, and she turns and looks at him, and the credits start roll. I don't think she blinks.
It stays on her face. It stays on her face the whole time as she's processing everything that's happened, everything that is happening in front of her, and everything that's going to happen. And the way she processes it, the way that it's on, it's acting you cannot teach.
Yeah.
It's just the mark of a miraculous talent, really.
It is, and she doesn't blink, and she's staring the whole time through the credits, and I think that added just a little bit to her character, because you're just like, oh, there's the girl we saw at the beginning of the film right there. You know, even after everything and with the love that she's felt, that girl is still there, and she just offed the pedo guy. I loved how that film ended. Glenn, what about you? Did you like how this film ended with her staring, and it was live action? It wasn't like a freeze frame like we would get back then.
Oh yeah, I love that. I just, the her staring out like that is, it's so perfect for her character. Because there is, I think partly because I think there's no matter, even now that she has pneumonia boy in her life, there's an emptiness to her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is. There's a little bit of a cold edge that her father built into her that he built up into her and warned her about her mom. And there's that girl that you look at the end credits, you go, yeah, I can believe she just killed her mom without blinking. Because her mom was, talking about how she wanted to live with her that. And
well, she didn't realize what she was doing when she killed her, though. She didn't. She says she didn't know what it was until after. Well, but, you know, still, she's not exactly broken up by the whole deal either. She's no. Just
and I'm not sure about that. If for me, I don't know if she with her mom, if she did truly not know, or if she kind of suspected, but did anyway. You know, it's like one of those things where she could have played it off with, you know, Mario, so she doesn't completely scare him away by saying, "Oh yeah, I poisoned my mom. Yeah, no, I just straight up killed her." You know, maybe she was playing it off a little that, oh no, I didn't know the powder was gonna kill her. but yeah, I love the credit sequence and this whole film, and it was rated PG, which is impressive because there is a rather uncomfortable nude scene in here, which we've run into a number of times now in 1976 with characters that were underage. Different times, that's for sure. But I like it was interesting on the trivia because apparently Jodie Foster fought not to be the scene, so they put her 21-year-old sister in because I guess she wore a wig anyway, so they just put the wig on her sister. But I thought that that scene was just like, yep, you're watching a 1976 film. Scott, what about you? Did you feel it was like that didn't really need that?
Oh, I think it was fine that they put it in because I do think now there's still a question. I thought that the IMDb trivia section, for instance, was a little unreliable in saying whether she likes the movie as it stands or not. It says she mentioned a movie and you can kind of think that it's this one.
Sure.
I think that's a little what can't be denied is that yeah, they had to do this, and she fought against this, and she doesn't feel good about this sequence, and I can see that. I think that there's probably somebody on the production team, and I don't know who it was. I will not, you know, slander anybody by, like, guessing, but there was somebody on the production side who sounds like they're kind of like Martin Sheen's character, wanted to see more flesh on these underage characters. It's uncomfortable to watch. I think it says something that it's more uncomfortable for us to watch somebody disrobing, a young girl disrobing, than it is watching a young girl kill people. But, it's because, you know, we're pretty sure that, you know, our sons and daughters aren't going to be killing people, God willing, but you know, that they might be getting up to this. It is their age, and you just hope everybody makes the right decisions. And it's very uncomfortable to watch this because you don't want to think about sexuality with, you know, people this young. However, I think it was handled, you know, very well and very tastefully, so I didn't have a problem with it. Let's not forget that let's look at the other films, and I'm not saying that she was like a magnet for roles like this. Because she totally wasn't. She's done everything. I mean, one of the movies she did in 1976 was A Freaky Friday. Another one was a family drama about a terminally ill child. Yeah, another one was Bugsy Malone, where she basically played what was supposed to be a hooker. And then there was Taxi Driver, which she totally did play a hooker.
Mm-hmm.
And even Jodie Foster if you can find on YouTube or something at an award ceremony for to honor Martin Scorsese, tells a funny story about how Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro were too terrified and timid to tell her what to do in the scene where she's trying to seduce Travis Bickle in that scene. And she was the one who's saying okay, so you want me to just, you know, go and do this? Well, yes, but, okay, well, do you want me to do that right now? No. You know, it's like this very funny speech she gives. But that is, of course, showing that, you know, it's a horrible transaction in that scene, right? It's not really about sex.
No.
It's about ownership. It's about degradation. This is actually about love. It's still extremely uncomfortable to watch. Don't get me wrong. I do think it was handled tastefully, and I think especially with the stories about the producer or or somebody on the staff or whatever being as pervy and disgusting as they were, it's a miraculous that it came. It's miraculous that it came off as well as it did, in being true to the character.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, we're not used to seeing. And it's good that we're not used to seeing this, that we're not used to seeing young people sexualized in that way.
Well,
it is something we don't want. We don't want people that young to be doing it. They are not a lot of them. You know, I mean, most people I know waited a few years at least, but they are definitely having those feelings at that time, and I think it's kind of disconcerting to see them put into action. However, I think it was true to this character, and I think it's good that it was as tastefully done as it was.
I felt like it felt a little out of place, though. I mean, I know what they were trying to go for. They're playing their conversation off as they're talking, but they handle it better in the beginning when he's cold and she decides to warm him, and she asks if you've ever done it before, and he goes, oh yeah, hundreds of times, like her answer with the, you know, smoking pot. And then we cut away to them where he's leaving and she's kind of in a robe type thing, and it's, you know, the kind of little more of the old school, the camera pans away as they kiss on the bed sort of thing, and then you see the next day. And then we get this scene in there. And I guess for me, I felt like it wasn't needed to get the point across.
They might have been able to do it with the other, just leave it at the other way and just leave it where it was. And the audience, maybe they would have known, maybe they would have thought, well, they maybe didn't really do it. They maybe just fell asleep in the art trailer's arms. But, you know, they did it the way they did it. And it's extremely uncomfortable, but it's more tastefully done than you would expect.
Yeah.
And let's face it, that she being somebody who is as cultured as she is, she knows that when people are in love, this is something people do when they're in love.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I guess for me, I just felt like it the way the rest of the film had been done, I guess for me, it was just a little bit more blatant than I needed, because everything else was done a little bit more subtly with some things, you know, for me. But it wasn't just the uncomfortable part of it. It was just, I was like, oh, we're going that far. You know, they could have easily had her turn the lights off and crawl into bed with him, and you get the point. I just didn't think the nudity was in there, but you know, it's European, right?
Yeah, and I like their conversation. I like their conversation. Because it kind of shows that it's the difference between love and sex, and is that, you know, he's talking about, oh yeah, I mean, the football team, it's like almost all they talk about. And then he like looks at her and says, but I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to tell anybody about this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is just for us, which I thought was kind of nice. But as I said, yes, very extremely uncomfortable.
What about you, Cole? You think that's...
Yeah, somebody else chime in on this subject, please.
Cole or Glenn, did you feel that this scene maybe just they didn't need to go that far with it? I mean, I know it's 76, but still. Cole, what do you think?
Well, I think, it's obvious. I mean, some people may disagree. You know, since I've met all these new filmmakers, I find that the tolerance for, you know, just exploitative moments is really high out there. Here's what I will say. I think the ass shot is unnecessary, and that scene could exist without it. The whole scene.
Yes, I'd agree.
And I will also say this. You know, I've been making horror movies most of my life now, and I'm not saying I know anything more than anybody else, but it is astonishing how often, and it isn't just sleazy men, it's women themselves, how often people want to get sexual and naked, like, on camera when you don't really want them, you know, when you don't want that in your film, you know. And then when you need it in your film, of course, the well is dry. It just seems to be the way it works. But there is this push, and I can see Jodie Foster getting entirely pissed off, because there's always this push, like, you know, you need tits in your film. And no, I don't, dude. You know, fine, make a movie and have all the tits you want in it. I'm making my movie with my heart and my brain, and, you know, maybe if a boob falls out, you know, in the moment, fine, you know. But anyways, that's what I will say, is that if you're making films of this sort, like, people really want you to have boobs in them, and the most creative people will automatically say, we're not going to rely on boobs, and then it just goes back and forth until, you know, usually the artist is fired, or, you know, or somebody just shoots it on their own. That, what's that movie, The Prophecy, from, like, it was a feminist horror film, and they added a rape scene later without the director. So, yeah, I'll say that. I mean, you know, I Scott said it better than I could. I probably sound angrier than I need to. But
no, it's okay.
You have your own angle on it. Go do it. Do it.
Yeah,
but
your own angle.
I will say that I like the scene. Like Scott said, I like the dialogue, and I like the fact that they went from, they're uncomfortable, I've done this hundreds of times, to climbing into bed. You know, obviously some time has lapsed. And I would never, you know, throw down a moral hammer and say we should not portray a teenage sex life on film. That's idiotic. But the butt shot, I mean, come on, what is that?
I'd agree with that. It was not necessary. It was it showed a certain casualness on the part of her character, which I could assume is part of, as I said, her maturity and how she has been raised to view relationships of this sort. But as you say. You could have panned up, you know. You could have focused on him. You could have done and had Herlin come around, you know. Yeah, it wasn't necessary.
Yeah, you could have that dialogue. Glenn, would you agree that they could have probably handled that scene, still had the dialogue, and not needed to show as much as they did?
What? yeah, of course they could have. It's the easy way out.
Mm-hmm.
These types of scenes in films are often done because it's easy. And I mean, nowadays I think they're even less needed because, for fuck's sake, if I want to see a booby, I have the internet.
Google booby. There you go.
I don't need Google. I can just click some of the banner ads on a normal website.
And right? Jesus.
If you don't even ask for it, it's there.
Yeah.
It's like, God, be careful what you wish for.
Check your spam folder. There you go. Just check your spam folder. There you go.
I mean, they pop up when you aren't even looking for it. They just pop up. You'll do searches, and it's like, why is that in the search? That makes no sense at all.
Did the nudity seem a little, I mean, not just the uncomfortable part of it, but did it seem out of place? Because, like, for me, it just didn't fit, like, the rest of the film. The dialogue did, but the visual didn't.
Yeah, well, mostly. I mean, or partly. Like I said, I don't think it was necessary. I think they'd already gotten everything across. We already know, okay, it's a dark movie. It's like, oh, no, we're gonna show. It's like, you already showed me. I already know. It's at a point where it's being gratuitous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I think stood out for me, was with the way the rest of the film was handled. It's the one scene where it just felt gratuitous. I'm like, I really wish they wouldn't have done it that way, because this film would even be better for me. But it's still a great film, and I think we'll wrap up here just to give our final thought with The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane. See if it aged well, and would you recommend it to anyone? And Glenn, we'll start with you. Your final thoughts with Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane.
I like the film. I mean, it's like I said, I saw it last, you know, 20 plus years ago.
Sure.
So I didn't remember it when you first said it. It's like, oh yeah, sure, I'll do whatever this is. Sure, why not? And then I looked it up. I'm like, oh God, I vaguely remember this movie. And then as I was watching it, I'm like, no. I would definitely recommend this for people. If it's got some really good acting. Jodie Foster is a really, really good actor. I've always recognized her as someone who has just a tremendous amount of talent. And I mean, the fact that she's 13 when she made this is just freaking ridiculous, along with Taxi Driver the same freaking year. definitely. I mean, this is definitely one worth checking out. I mean, it is not going to be for everyone, because first of all, a lot of people just have problems with anything made pre 2012 or whatever, you know. That's an old person. That's an old person movie. That's an old person movie. Shut up. So yeah, definitely, I think it's worth checking out.
Awesome. And Cole, how about you, sir? Your final thoughts with this film?
Oh man, Mark, I really liked it. I don't know. I had a bit of a different take on it than you guys. I mean, first of all, I'd recommend it to anybody, obviously, if they're listening to this episode. They've spoilers. It's the spoiler room. I would, recommend this film highly. And also, to me, my take on the film was just that it was kind of an uplifting tale. I felt like she was really in control of the situation. And when things started to spiral out of control, like when she couldn't start the car, love showed up and kind of hoisted her and saved her. And to me, the movie symbolically ends on a high note with her conquering this raging pedo and winning the turkey, which I think was a great little touch. She gets the call and she's won the turkey. And when she's asked, you know, you think you can survive on your own? And she says, well, I thought I could. It doesn't strike me as a depressed statement. It strikes me as we find out a few seconds later, the doctor says her lover is going to live. So I viewed the whole film as this young girl conquering abusive adults. And maybe in a couple days I'll come out. But those are my final thoughts on the film. I would put it alongside like Donnie Darko or it's hard to – the genre is so small, but a really good, dark teen film that I think teenagers of the time who saw it were probably very fortunate, you know, young people. Yeah. I'd love to have more films like this now. So thanks for bringing this movie to my attention, Mark. I never would have seen it, man. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear you enjoyed it. That's even better that you got a kick out of it. So, and Scott, how about you, sir? Your final thoughts with this film?
I actually look at it the same way Cole does. I think it is an uplifting film. I think that it's you go in, as I said, I did when I saw it like 15 years ago or however long it was. You go in expecting a horror film, and you're expecting Jodie Foster to be the monster. And she's not. Everybody, I mean, a lot of other people are. The Hallett family certainly is. But she isn't. Even though you have to come around to, well, I don't know if I really approve of the way this person is living. I mean, if I had heard anything like that going on in real life, Lord knows, I'd be horribly concerned. You know, the movie gets you on her side. It teaches you a new way to look at a young person and that they're not all fragile. Some of them know exactly what they're doing. Some of them are smarter than we give them credit for. Especially this person who's kind of been torn between these two worlds of, you know, childhood and adulthood. And I think that Jodie Foster tackles this role so incredibly. It's really a testament to just, you know, how she would continue to be amazing for the next 40 years and counting. Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane is just a really amazing film. There's not too many other films like it. And it was one of a handful of films that came out in the mid-70s, very, very early 80s, even pre-John Hughes, which gave you a new way of looking at young people that was not the typical exploitation or family film. It actually gave you a new window into what they were thinking. And I think it's an incredible movie. I would basically recommend it to just about anybody.
And I have to agree. I would have recommended it to just about anyone as well. It's even though it's set in 76, even with the clothes and the you know, the cars, even with that point, it doesn't feel too dated. But you don't really care because Jodie Foster's performance in this is, as you've picked up through the probably this whole podcast, stands out so strong.
Yes.
It's worth it watching that and watching even, you know, Sheen's character and his performance and everything about this film. It's supposed to make you feel a little uncomfortable, but at the same time, you know, maybe see things a little bit differently. And make you question how you see things, especially teenagers, and maybe make you think of them possibly more as just those annoying teenagers, but even look at them as young adults. And yeah, I recommend it to just about anyone. If you're looking for an interesting film that's got some tense moments, it's dark. It is considered a drama thriller more so than, you know, horror film, but that line's usually blurred. But it's definitely one that I think, you know, you could watch. There's not really a lot of blood or gore. Most of the horror is implied, more or less, as well. So, and outside of the one scene I didn't think was necessary, yeah, definitely agree. So, hope that gets you interested, folks, and didn't ruin too much for you for the film, but still see it for the rest because it needs to be seen. This film, I think, needs to be talked about more, in all honesty. I think it's one of those gems that if you mention it, a lot of people know about it, but you don't hear too many people talk about it, and it's a really well done film in general. So we'll go down the line real quick then and let the crew tell you where you can find them at when they are not here. Go ahead, Cole.
Oh man, again, thanks for having me, Mark. My name is Cole Meredith. I'm an independent filmmaker. You can find my page at Shadows and Lovers Productions on Facebook. The movie On the Horizon is the last great horror movie coming for a digital release very soon. Also, Horror Roar, which is a page where I tool around with some digital art and just rant and rave about one of my favorite genres, which is the horror arena. Or, you know, if you just want to shoot the shit and talk movies, you can find me on Facebook under Cole Meredith.
Awesome. And Glenn, go ahead.
You can find me on the interwebs on Facebook with Guy in a Bunker Productions and the B-Movie Bunker, also on YouTube, same thing. Or just follow me on Twitter at Guy in a Bunker.
Awesome. And Scotty D, how's Moviacrity coming?
Well, it's been pretty quiet this last year, but I'm looking to get it geared up again for the next year. Awesome. The other stuff is still there for anybody to see and catch up on, so that you can catch that at moviacrity.com. Also, my web series, Moviocrity, which is at on vimeo.com/channel/Moviocrity. If you're super lazy, you can just look up the show on YouTube, but you're not going to get all the episodes, and you'll have to sign in, and it's a real pain in the ass, so just go to Vimeo.
Plus, the copyright and censored Nazis go after his Moviocrity videos. So.
Oh, almost every single one, yeah. I mean, and a couple of them aren't there anymore, even though it's all perfectly legit, legal, on the level. You know, lots of people with YouTube channels have had that problem. So,
yes, and that's the joys of YouTube. This is the YouTube police. The spoiler room is now closed. No, I'm sorry.
I wouldn't put it past them. Like the freaking NFL, man.
Eddie, you can find links to all their sites as well as our archive and our stuff at specialmarkproductions.com. We are on iTunes as well as Stitcher Radio. Please subscribe, like, and rate us. Always love to hear feedback from you. We appreciate you listening in. And we are rounding out the year. We got one more big 4-0 special coming up this month. We're going to be talking about next week about a holiday-themed film. Stay tuned. We'll be telling you more about that. And at the end of the year, we will be doing a 2016 wrap-up of sorts. So lots of great stuff coming up here in the Spoiler Room. Thank you for listening. Now say goodnight, gentlemen.
Good night.